Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined tonight for a discussion of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, after some time away, by Eric Asperschlager. Good day, Eric.
Good day.
I said good day.
Yeah, no, that was good. It has been a while since I've been on the podcast.
It's been a while.
I know.
I see what you did.
I didn't do that on purpose.
You teed really me up there. Listen, the last time Eric was on, it was a traumatic experience for both of us. We recorded multiple podcasts on The Exorcist. You can find them by going to fthismovie.net. You cannot find them in the iTunes store because it is our lost episode. But speaking of which, if you do want to find our shows, you can find a bunch of them in the iTunes store, just not that one. But you can find everything at fthismovie.net. You should follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. You should like us on Facebook if you haven't already. And you can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Eric, have you recovered from the Exorcist episode?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously, you know, part of our court-mandated therapy, this podcast. You know, I mean, I don't think either one of us would have chosen this movie, you know, on purpose. But yes, no, it's been that was around Halloween time, which is fast approaching again.
Which is amazing to me that we're already halfway around again. So we're going to be talking about Willy Wonka and probably some of the Tim Burton version because Eric is a trooper and does his homework. But before we do that, Eric, have you seen anything good lately?
I have. I'll talk about a few things, two of which were recommended by you.
Woohoo!
Or I read that you liked them or heard that you liked. I don't know, you didn't tell me directly to watch them, but and then the third, I think you haven't seen, you hadn't as of a few weeks ago.
I think I have by now because I think I know what it's going to be.
Okay. The interesting thing about all three of these movies is that they're all less than 90 minutes each.
Right on.
Which I really like these days. I have to. There was a time where I thought, you know, sub 90 minutes, you know, was a mark of inferior quality, and that you had, you know, I wanted the most movie for my. I wanted 2+ hours, and now if I see a running time over 120 minutes, I roll my eyes and know that I'm going to be watching it in two sittings because I just, there's no way I can. So these sub 90 minute movies are a beautiful thing because I am old.
Running time dictates so many of my viewing choices, especially during June Sploitation where I'm trying to knock something out every day. I'm like, 80 minutes, you're the winner. So.
Exactly. So the first one, I mean, maybe you have seen this. I finally saw the Purge.
Yes, that's what I thought it was going to be. I did too.
Yeah, and I probably wouldn't have tracked it down if not for kind of two things. One, I think JB didn't said it wasn't the worst on a podcast.
I believe he did say it is not the worst.
That is not the worst. And then I saw a trailer for the sequel, The Purge Anarchy, and I don't think I really knew what the setup for the first movie was or the second one either. And it was intriguing to me. I thought, oh, that's interesting. It's, you know, there's this near future where one night a year all crime is legal, which basically means murder is legal because that's kind of what they do. And so I thought, oh, okay, that sounds interesting. I'll track it down. And hey, it's 86 minutes. You're the winner. To quote Patrick Bromley. So watch it. I liked it. I think for the most part, I enjoyed it. I thought it, you know, it's kind of like Bottle Episode, the movie, and that it all kind of takes place in this one house. And you know, it's not too subtle about its themes, but I think that it at least has something to say about kind of has versus have nots, and kind of plays through the idea of, you know, in this world where one night a year, you know, everyone gets to go nuts, the people who have the money are able to afford the security systems that supposedly protect them. And the movie follows one wealthy family who things do not go so well for. But I thought it worked okay. I mean, what did you think?
I was maybe a little bit more frustrated by it than you. I think it's a really interesting premise, although I will fully admit that I do not understand why making all crime legal one night would rule it out. The other 360, everybody's like, nope, got that out of my system. No crime for 364 days. Like, but listen, we have to be willing to accept the premise. And I wish they would explore some other crimes. I wish one person would, like, commit larceny, but whatever, they go straight to murder.
Yeah, I mean, I would rob a bank.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you know, and then you can afford the security system the next year. You gotta,
then you'd be all set for
you
the Purge.
Pull yourself up by your murderous bootstraps. That's America.
I think the sequel looks real. Like, I really like the trailers for the sequel, and it looks like they're actually going to explore the premise that they set up. And I think that's my frustration about the first movie, is that it sets up an interesting idea and then just does kind of a home invasion movie. And I agree that there's more to it than that. There's kind of more social commentary than just the standard, like, people want to break in and kill us. I thought it was well directed. Like, I think it's a well-made movie. And to be honest, now that I know that there's a sequel that is going to sort of explore the larger universe of it, I think I'm going to be way more willing to give the first one a pass.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, it's just a different take on, you know, in this Purge movie, we get to see what's going on in one of the houses. And in this Purge movie, we go out to the streets. And now they need to make a third Purge movie that opens it up even bigger. I don't know how they would, but
in a shopping mall.
There you go. That's where all good horror movies take place.
Exactly. I'd say I'm worried about the second one kind of taking the larger approach, kind of digging into the specifics of it. One of the things I like about the first one is that it just sort of suggests things. And I know that's, you know, kind of partly to hide whatever budgetary or whatever limitations there may have been in shooting the movie. Most of the kind of sense of what's happening in the larger world happens in snippets of cable news broadcasts or something coming over the radio or just kind of a passing comment. I'm worried that they're going to get a little bit too much into the details of, you know, who are the new founding fathers and what's happening in all these specific places. And,
sure.
You know, but it could work. I mean, I kind of like the sense that it sort of suggests some of those things. Like, it suggests that, oh, hey, you live this future America where unemployment is at, you know, really low rate. And isn't that great? And, oh, that's because all the poor people are killed one night a year.
Yeah, right.
You know, you kind of realize that kind of stuff. It's like, they have an interesting premise where, you know, just statistically, I can see why you could convince a populace, you know, in a movie sense, why this is a good thing, because the people who survive are the ones who make it to the next one. So, of course, they're going to think that it's a good thing. So I thought it wasn't, you know, it's not perfect. This is the F this movie, take a drink. I think that it plays it pretty straight. There aren't so much twists as there are kind of moments where maybe you forgot that someone was in the house, which
right.
is kind of what happened to me.
Right.
They kind of set a lot of pieces in motion at once. And then a lot of it is just kind of keep track of who is where and when. And that's kind of how it plays out. So I thought they did a pretty good job. I didn't find it too frustrating. I thought for 86 minutes, it was just right.
Here's a question. Why the masks? Like, I know it looks cool and it's an interesting visual, and obviously they were able to sell the movie to the point where I think they torpedoed the box office chances of Your Next, which is a movie I like a lot more. But if murder is legal, why hide your identity?
I mean, there's a bit of a kind of a cult aspect to I guess America at this point, and you kind of have that this sense of like these people are going out and purging their souls, so they think, even though it's just kind of a excuse to kill. So I could see it. They don't go into it, that in the movies. This
right.
is me just kind of trying to justify, you know, the costume designer's cool choice one night after.
Well, because
you know.
Then it sets up that there's another group of people, and I won't say who, but they don't disguise themselves. They're just themselves.
Right. Right.
Hey, whatever. Yet, I mean, this is a stupid nitpick.
They still share the same sort of like, you know, spouting of rhetoric and almost kind of cult-like
right.
behavior. So I don't know. That it was a cool visual. So
yeah, right. Exactly. I guess that's all it's for, really.
I'm a sucker. I'm a cheap day. If you're less than 90 minutes. You
know, no, I mean, I definitely thought.
You're getting in my cinematic pants.
I definitely thought it was fine, you know, like probably a little bit better than fine. I'm not a huge home invasion genre fan, and I thought this one was probably a little bit better than a lot of other home invasion movies because, like you said, it does have some ideas behind it.
It also takes a different kind of point of view because in most home invasion movies, the invasion is a surprise. In this case,
right.
it's not an inevitability, but everyone knows that, you know, come 7 o'clock this night, you lock down and kind of just try to survive until the morning.
Right.
So,
right.
so at least you have like, you know something is coming and it's about anticipating that. So,
right. What besides The Purge?
I finally checked out Cheap Thrills.
Oh, okay.
Which is now on Amazon Prime Instant Video. So
yes.
check that out. And I liked it a lot. This is the movie with the people from The Innkeepers who are playing people not like they play The Innkeepers.
Pat Healy and Sarah Paxton.
Thank you very much. And it's another movie that kind of that plays its premise very straight. This being that there's kind of an escalating series of not exactly dares, but you know, things that people are asked to do for financial compensation. People who need the money, and it basically just kind of escalates. It's not like, again, there are a lot of like twists in the movie. It's just that things kind of get worse.
Right.
And I thought it was great. I mean, I think, you know, compared to something like The Purge, like there are real characters in this movie. You know, there are only around 4 main actors in it. David Kushner? Kuchner?
Kechner.
Kechner. Thank you very much. It was great. It was great in the movie. Pat Healy's great. I mean, everyone's great in the movie. I really enjoyed it. And I also appreciated that they didn't go as gruesome as they could have. Like, sure, a lot of the stuff that happens is either shown very quickly or it's kind of happens off screen. So it's a lot more kind of suggestion than, you know, in your face violence, which I also respect because I am old.
That's still one of my favorite movies of the year so far. And it's a hard movie to sort of categorize because it's not horror. It's sort of, a black comedy, but it's like really black, if we're going to call it that.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I know because I want to compare things, it kind of has some similar ideas to The Purge in the sense that it's about, you know, the wealthy and the people who, you know, need money and kind of who has their boot on who and how, you know, the control they have.
But, which is a theme that we're seeing pop up in a lot of movies these days. And I can't imagine that it has anything to do with reflecting the current culture or
I assume it's from some screenwriting book.
That's exactly. Right now. It's just happens to be a coincidence. Like when they make 2 asteroid movies in the same year, it just, it's one of those things that just happens.
Absolutely. So, so I enjoyed that. And then, very different from either of the first 2 movies I watched, They Came Together.
Oh, nice.
The new, Wayne Showalter, movie. And, it is every bit as funny as you promised. And you set the bar very high with your,
I did. I might have gone a little overboard, but I'm glad to hear that maybe I didn't.
No, it's really fun. I was a little worried going in that it would be the kind of movie that I really appreciated and at the end said, you know what? That was great. I can't wait to see it again to really get into it and get all the jokes. But it had me laughing kind of right from the beginning.
Yeah.
It's super funny. And this is a movie that's basically a kind of like the Wet Hot Americans. The Wet Hot Americans summer crew taking on romantic comedies. Although I think that that's a little bit easy because it's more a parody of lazily written Hollywood movies in general.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, obviously there's a structure that's, you know, a lot like something like You Got Mail or some of those other 90s rom-coms. But really, it's just kind of about all the cliches and the Hollywood tropes with Paul Rudd and Amy Poehler as the leads, with basically everyone else comedically in the movie, which is amazing. Even Adam Scott and is in there as a little cameo.
That was very funny.
With John Stamos. That was great. I mean, it had me laughing. I think, I don't know what's exactly the opening scene. There's a quick shot that kind of got me in, and it's barely a joke, but there's a, you know, see, I think it's the opening scene, and you see Paul Rudd has just finished laughing and he's holding a glass of wine and he opens his mouth super wide to take a drink. It's just like, and they cut away instantly. But I laugh and I'm like, okay, I know what you're going for. And then when he's singing into the shower head, I'm like, okay.
Yeah. 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 Was the,
is
the,
I know.
Is the Bill Hader joke where I don't want to spoil the joke. He makes the sign for check.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Is that fairly early?
Yeah, that's right before they start telling the story.
Okay. I mean, I saw the movie as part of it was the opening night movie for Chicago Critics Film Festival. And it was a packed theater. David Wayne was there. And the audience was way into it. Like, apparently there were even people from the studio, I think Lionsgate is putting it out, who were basically like calling back to some of their bosses saying, like, you would not believe what's going on in Chicago right now because the movie just played like crazy. But that joke with Bill Hader making the check sign, I laughed so loud, and I'm pretty sure I was the only one who laughed. I embarrassed myself a little bit. Yeah.
It's the kind of movie where there are jokes that you're not even sure if they're meant to be jokes. I mean, like you could describe that, you know, thing that he does, and you could say, well, you know, he's obviously just kind of wants to get out of there. But for whatever the reason, the way it plays, it's like that is a hilarious joke. Yeah, it's I mean, it's full of so many. Like I kept kind of just thinking about things after the facts and kind of went back and forth with Adam Risky a little bit on Twitter about it. But there's so many. It's just so packed, so dense. It's another movie I can't wait to go back and watch again, even though I got a lot out of it the first time. So it's a very reasonable rental. I rented it on Amazon for like $7, which is in HD.
Yeah, right.
High definition, all of the pixels.
And it's really too bad that it's not getting a wider release because while I recognize that it's not going to be the kind of comedy for everyone, and I don't even know if it would, you know, pack theaters, but it is the kind of movie that is so much fun to see with an audience. That scene where Paul Rudd goes into the bar and talks to the bartender. I can't even tell you what that did to the theater when I was in it. The way that that built was really incredible. And so, again, it's obviously very funny at home too, but it's too bad that they're not kind of giving it more of a chance.
Yeah. And also really weird that it's getting as mixed reviews as it is. And I think comedy is super subjective and, you know, the people who I think are giving it not great reviews are just going to end up on the wrong side of history when all is said and done. But at the same time, it's weird to me. I don't know. Cause it's so good. It's so great.
It is. I mean, I recognize that the jokes are for a kind of specific sense of humor. And it's obviously one that we all kind of share, at least at F This Movie, which is one of the reasons that we all get along so well. But I would think even as a critic, even if the jokes aren't necessarily exactly to your liking, A, I think there's enough different kinds of jokes that something would land with you. And B, as you said, it's so smart about the way that it zeroes in on so many different cliches that as a critic, you would just think you would just be so relieved that it's like, oh, somebody else gets it. Like somebody else sees all of the things that I have sat through dozens and dozens of times and is making fun of it. And, like you said, comedy is subjective, right?
So, it's not like I've loved every single movie David Wayne has ever put out.
No,
it seems like I've enjoyed them all. But I mean, like, Wet Hot American Summer, bona fide classic, and then you jump to this, and it's like this is basically the same thing. Seems to me, this seems to be the next milestone, and it's gonna hopefully there's at least another one somewhere down the road.
Yeah, right. And I'm sure eventually this will sort of develop a cult around it the way that Wet Hot American Summer took some time to do.
So in that sense, the negative reviews are doing the movie a favor because you want to give it just enough. you want people to look down on it just enough that it can really kind of come back.
Yeah, right.
The third act. And
I'm actually glad you said, and I'm not going to talk about this too much because by the time this podcast comes out, the review will be up. But you had said something about being on the right side of history, which is very much the foundation of the review that I just wrote and will be running again by the time this comes out at fthismovie.net for Snowpiercer, the new Bong Joon-ho movie. I talk a lot about being on the right side of history with this movie and getting on board with it now and not letting it be another Blade Runner where it's like, oh, after 10 years or 20 years, then everybody starts to say, oh, right, this is a masterpiece. It's super, super, super good. It's my favorite movie of the year so far. Obviously, the year's not over, but it's playing in very limited release right now. And I believe the Friday that this podcast comes out, this will come out on a Wednesday. So the Friday is July 11th. I believe, don't quote me on this, that the movie is going to VOD platforms and iTunes and Amazon. So if it is not playing near you, do make it a point to check it out at home. I really think it's worth everyone's time. That was that. I talked about The Purge. I was catching up with some movies from last summer, so I got to see The Purge, and I finally got around to seeing R.I.P.D., which came out last summer and was a huge bomb. And it is one of the most depressing movies I've ever seen, only because of how mediocre it is. Like, the last week we've been talking a lot about Transformers because it's bad and it made all this money, and then we're all asking, how do these movies get made and why do people go see them? And Transformers is terrible. And But at least it's, it shows the hallmark of an author. Like, there's authorship to it. Michael Bay is an auteur. I dislike almost all of his choices. I think he makes ugly, hateful, garbage movies. But I could tell that it's his movie. RIPD is like, it, you can't understand how hundreds of millions of dollars got spent on this movie that no one seems to give a shit about. Not the actors, not the director. It's wall-to-wall bad CGI. Is it a comedy? Is it a comic book movie? It tries to be all this. It's essentially, you know, Men in Black, only without the personality and talent behind it. And it's just, it's such a terrible and yet accurate representation of sort of where we are in terms of this blockbuster mentality where everything's done on a computer and sort of packaged together in this way. Like, this should be put in a time capsule.
Now, was it, I don't know very little about the movie. Is it about the ghost cops or something?
Well, here's the, yeah, they're cops who are like dead, and they, when they die, then they join the RIPD.
Is it a spoiler to say that they're dead?
It is not. No, that's the, that's the premise of the movie. No, no, no.
Okay.
It's Men in Black. I mean, whereas Men in Black were secretly fighting aliens, these guys are secretly fighting, like, escaped dead people? I couldn't even tell you. There's a blue light coming from the sky at the end, as there is in every movie, and we have to worry about, like, our world giving way to their world, which is another thing that shows up in every movie. Mm-hmm. Really, really just depressingly mediocre. Not even actively bad in the way that a Transformers movie is. Just so mediocre.
Now, is it based on a pre-existing property?
It is, yeah. It's a comic book, and it's been in development for years, and they really spent over $100 million on this. Jeff Bridges is in it, like, really embarrassing himself. Kevin Bacon, who's way too talented an actor to make some of the garbage that he makes. Yeah, the whole thing just bummed me out.
Do you think Kevin Bacon sometimes makes movies just to connect people? Like, you
he
know
must.
What I mean?
Yeah, he was worried that Ryan Reynolds and Jeff Bridges weren't connected enough. So he's like, I'll do you guys a solid. I'll show up in RIPD.
I have to imagine that there is, you know, somewhere in the back end of IMDb, some sort of database that, you know, someone, a checklist that Kevin Bacon can go and look at and just say, okay, I have to work with this person, and this person. Because if he does work with everyone, then the blue light appears and we and his world takes over our world. And
I'm so tired of the blue light shooting into the sky. I'm so, even in movie, I mean, I liked Avengers, but like, I'm done with the blue light in the sky. I saw Disconnect, which came out, I believe, last year. And I remember when JB saw it, he referred to it as Crash for the Internet. And that's exactly what it is. It's one of these dramas. And it was made by a guy named Henry Alex Rubin, I believe, making his narrative debut. He made a documentary called Murder Ball, which is actually really good and worth seeing. Disconnect, not so much. It tells all these different stories about people who run into problems because they're on the internet, where one couple has their identities stolen and their bank accounts are cleared out because the woman was like in a chat room with someone, and a kid is sort of cyber bullied or tricked into taking naked pictures of himself, and then he's humiliated. And another woman gets drawn into the scary world of webcams. And, it's like a movie written about the internet by 75-year-old people with only sort of a loose understanding of the internet as a terrifying place.
I mean, if you want to make a movie about the internet as a terrifying place, I'm sure there are some subreddits you could go to that would make this thing look like, you know, AOL.
Yeah, right.
Like, you know, if you, sorry, I accidentally typed in the wrong keyword on AOL and I saw someone's midriff is a pretty far cry from, you know.
Yeah, what actually
pony
is
sex.
Yeah, exactly. The actual scary things going on. So it's this movie that, like, it means well, and it has a cast that's way overqualified. Jason Bateman and Hope Davis and Frank Grillo and Paula Patton and Alexander Skarsgård and Andrea Riseborough. Like, a lot of good actors are in this, and it looks and feels like a real movie, but then it's sort of laughable underneath, and it's not worth anyone's time.
Was it also in development for a long time?
I don't think so, although okay. You would swear they started writing it in 1996.
It seems like the kind of movie that could just kind of, you know, fall apart because it was started too early when some of this stuff was an actual concern on the,
right.
On the
internet. Right. It really tries to be about, you know, our modern times, but it's pretty embarrassing. And the last movie I'll talk about very quickly is a movie called Gambit, which is a remake of a 1966 film starring Michael Caine and Shirley MacLaine. And that's a delightful little caper movie. And this movie is not. This has Colin Firth and Cameron Diaz in the Shirley MacLaine role. And it's been around for a while. They shot it a year or two ago. It's sort of been put on the back burner and barely got a theatrical release a few months ago. It's really noteworthy only because its screenplay is by Joel and Ethan Coen, and they don't often write scripts that they don't themselves direct. You wouldn't know necessarily that they had written this script because I didn't feel like it bared any of the hallmarks of their work. It's just mostly generic and bad. Alan Rickman is in it, and I've gone to bat for Cameron Diaz before on this podcast. I think once upon a time she did some interesting work, mostly early in her career. And then recently she has really been out to disprove me and make me look the fool, because I don't know if she's just supremely miscast in this movie or just truly giving a terrible performance, but every moment that she's on screen had me cringing. The movie is currently available on Netflix Instant, so go ahead and watch it, everyone. you should definitely skip Gambit.
Is it less than 90 minutes?
89.
All right.
You're going to be watching Gambit tonight.
Gambit tonight?
Yeah, so I really can only recommend Snowpiercer.
Okay.
Should we talk about Willy Wonka?
Might as well.
All right, let's do that. Now, I'm going to let you sort of go first because you had suggested this because ...
Because this is obviously, as a movie, it's been kind of part of my life for a long time. In as much as it was a part of my life when I was a kid, big important thing. When I was a kid, I loved reading Roald Dahl books. I think I saw the movie before I read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, on which the movie's based. But recently, I've started reading Roald Dahl books with my daughter, and we read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and she loved it, and it was great to read it. And as I was reading it to her, I realized, oh, there's actually more of this in the movie than I thought. I was kind of thought as well, an adaptation that wasn't very faithful to the book. But I was like, oh, this is actually kind of more. I wonder if the movie holds up at all, or if it's really as miserable as I imagine it probably is, because I loved it when I was a kid. So I thought, well, this would be interesting. I have, you know, the book fresh in mind. Watch the movie. We can talk about, you know, our experiences with it, nostalgia, and, you know, adaptation. All the, you know, I think it's certainly ripe for us to find things to talk about. Whether we do or not will be the big twist in this particular episode.
You were able to go watch the Tim Burton one as well, right?
I was, yeah. I tracked a copy of that down, which I went to see. This is actually came out, what was it, 2005 or something like that. It came out at a time when I think I was still excited about a new Tim Burton movie. I have since lost that excitement for anything that Tim Burton does. But it was at a time where I thought, oh, Tim Burton – Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I have to actually use the right name. That sounds like a good fit. Roald Dahl, Tim Burton. Let's see what they can do. And I didn't like it when I saw it in the theater, and I went back and watched it. And we'll talk a bit about that later. So I have kind of all three versions pretty fresh in mind.
Okay, I tried really hard to find a copy of the book and find a copy of the Tim Burton movie. I haven't read the book since I was a kid. I haven't seen the Tim Burton movie since the week it opened in 2005. I remember not really liking it, and I'm just tired of Tim Burton. Like, his whole move is, let's take an existing property and, you know, make it shitty and put Johnny Depp in it.
So you have seen the movie.
I haven't seen it since then. But I was reading a little bit, just like on Wikipedia and stuff, trying to find, refresh my memory on certain things and reading about the original 71 movie, which is really going to be the focus of our conversation. I was surprised to learn that Roald Dahl was not happy with the script or that film and felt it deviated from the source material. And so I clicked through and, again, not being able to read the book, I just sort of read the plot summary on Wikipedia and it sounded identical to the 1971 movie. So are they that different?
There are a couple of pretty big deviations. Okay. Roald Dahl actually worked on the screenplay for the 1971 movie, although it was – I'm not sure how much of it was rewritten by David Seltzer, but it was basically at some point, I think I read also Wikipedia, that the doll wasn't meeting deadlines or something, so they handed it over.
Right.
And there were some other things that the producer and the director didn't like about what Dahl was doing. And the weird thing about this movie is that it seems like it was made for the absolutely the worst reasons by some of the worst people.
Sell candy.
Exactly the case.
Yeah.
I never knew this before I watched the making of documentary on the DVD that I have. But yeah, it was financed by Quaker Oats. They paid like all – I don't know if it was more than $3 million to make, but they shunk $3 million into this just so they could have a movie to tie in to a candy bar they were launching that they were going to call a Wonka bar. And it was all a tie-in. I mean, ostensibly it happened because the director's 10-year-old daughter said, "Daddy, you should make this movie." But really it happened because – Quaker Oats was launching a candy bar.
And so for as much as we sort of lament the sorry state of Hollywood and merchandising tie-ins, like, oh, this has been going on since 1971, everyone. I was surprised to learn that as well. And it made me think, hey, is Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory sort of the Lego movie of its day? Like a project born out of cynicism and marketing that somehow turned out to be really special and good.
Seems like, I guess – if you look at it purely from we're making this movie as a way to get this other thing we think would be more profitable. You could even say it goes back to something like A Hard Day's Night, which was made to kind of sell soundtracks, but was in itself obviously an amazing movie.
Right.
Movie that I saw recently.
What? You don't think we should plug your review for it at DVDverdict.com, do you?
I mean, I don't know. It was a pretty long review. I mean, it was like, 2,000 words. I'm sorry. So. Anyway, I was surprised to learn that the reason they changed the name from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is the name of the book, to Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory was because of the candy bar. They wanted to highlight the Wonka name because that was what they called the bar. So as far as the differences between the book and the movie, there are a bunch of deviations, but kind of the main difference, I think probably what Dahl objected to, one, there's the whole fizzy lifting drink scene, which is not in the book. And it's problematic because it basically takes Charlie, who's the character who basically does the right thing the whole way through the story and is rewarded for it, and makes him kind of just another, shitty kid who breaks the rules.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a problem. They also added Slugworth because
– Yeah, that I saw.
Because the producer felt that the story needed a villain for some reason.
Were the other four kids not enough?
I don't know. So they added this whole subplot about Slugworth, the rival candy maker, who is a character as much as he's mentioned in the book.
Right.
As one of the rival candy makers who sent spies into Wonka's factory before he shut it down. You know, it was closed for a while, then reopened, powered by the Oompa Loompa workforce. So they added Slugworth in as this thing, and the whole kind of, are the kids, the everlasting gobstopper as this true moral test of the kids. It's not about whether they can avoid, turning into blueberries and fall down, pits and that kind of thing. It's whether they take the everlasting gobstopper and give it over to Slugworth and get money. And they basically kind of sidestep the whole problem with Charlie and the fizzy lifting drink scene, which is when, he and Grandpa Joe steal, drink the stuff that Mr. Wonka says don't drink, and then manage to avoid being, sliced up by fan blades because they discover that they burp, they're fine. But they sidestep all that at the end by having Charlie give Wonka the gobstopper, and that proves that he's good at heart and all that kind of stuff. So those are pretty big differences from the book. Now, to be fair, in the book, Willy Wonka is not that fleshed out of a character. He's just kind of a bizarre you know, a tour guide who kind of just sits back and watches as, you know, one by one, the kids kind of fall away because they succumb to their various vices. So for the movie, I can see why they might want to try to flesh him out a bit more. And that's, I think, probably what happened with the Tim Burton version as well. They wanted to flesh out the character, and then they went way too far with Johnny Depp's character, and they basically turned it into a movie about him and not about Charlie.
Well, because Tim Burton has to just identify, okay, now who's the weirdo in my story? This guy? Let's make it about him. Let's give him daddy issues, because every character in one of my movies has to have daddy issues.
And it's crazy. And I know we're talking about the 71 version, but while I was watching the Burton version, like the first half of the movie, I thought this is good. Like this, they've taken the story, the basic kind of setup of the book, and they've rendered it really well. Like it looks great. You kind of really feel the poverty.
This is everything before they get to the factory, right?
Everything before they get to the factory.
Yeah.
And it's all pretty great. You know, one of the problems in rewatching the 71 version is that you never really get the sense of, you know, the Bucket family is kind of crushing poverty. You know, I mean, they seem poor. You know, all the grandparents have to sleep in one bed. His dad's dead for some reason. That's not in the book. It's weird. Like both adaptations, like even the Burton one, which is supposedly more true to the book, chooses to be different in weird ways. anyway, I don't know. It's all over the place. So as an adaptation, I'm glad that they decided to take some liberties. I can see why Dahl wasn't happy with all of them. I think at least one of the liberties they take with the fizzy lifting drink does kind of undermine some of the, you know, story. But
and you had tweeted out something about, of all the changes, only one is kind of really significantly changes it. Is that what you were referring to, I assume?
No. I was referring to Johnny Depp's Wonka it's like it all coming down to his dad, and that the whole end of the Burton one is about Willy Wonka like reconciling with his dentist father. At the end, the last bit of that movie just twists. It's not about the kids. It's not about
right.
It's just about, you know, Willy Wonka kind of learning to accept a family again. And Depp's characterization of Willy Wonka is just weird and creepy and
no, it's
mean spirited. Like he doesn't care about the kids. He hates their parents because he has the parental issues. He basically like. There, it's even suggested that he has like orchestrated the demise of four of these kids at least.
It's truly awful. It's so uninspired. It's such a weird just collection of eccentricities. And maybe let's start there, even though obviously we've already started. But I want to – as a way into why the 71 movie is – still, I think, rightfully considered a classic. And watching it today, it had been a long time since I had seen it. And there were things that I must have seen it enough times as a kid where I really kind of knew it by heart, even though I haven't seen it in at least 20 years. I was amazed at how long it takes to get to the factory. Yeah. It's almost half the movie before we get to the factory. And I felt like, okay, this is, you know, repeating itself a little bit. And there's a number of jokes about, you know, the extremes that anyone will go to bid on Wonka bars or not give up their Wonka, you know, the woman's husband is kidnapped. And it's a funny joke, but like it comes at the end of five similar jokes. But then they get to the factory and Gene Wilder shows up.
Yep.
And without Gene Wilder's characterization of Willy Wonka, I'm not positive that we're still talking about this movie.
No, I mean it's amazing that like both movies kind of live or die on their Wonka, which is again a character in the book that is obviously very important, but is not as fleshed out. And so you have, you know, Gene Wilder, who's so good in this movie that he's
so good,
and he doesn't exactly save it, but he keeps it going.
Yes.
Whereas you have Johnny Depp's Willy Wonka, who torpedoes the movie the minute he appears.
Absolutely.
And not just because of his mannerisms, but just the choices they made and who that character is, what motivates him, and how he reacts to everybody. It's just so off-putting and so terrible. So yeah. Gene Wilder, who was not the first choice to play the part at all. It's actually kind of interesting to read a bit about the casting process of coming up with Willy Wonka, because Roald Dahl wanted Spike Milligan of The Goon Show to play Willy Wonka. And then at some point it's suggested on Wikipedia that that almost all of the Monty Python troupe members were interested in it but didn't get the parts, and there are all these other people, and they finally settled on Gene Wilder. And it'd be fascinating to see – a version of this movie with almost any of those other comedians, but
I feel like I can picture what almost any of them would look like.
Yeah.
I think the only one who would come close to Gene Wilder, honestly, is Eric Idle.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Cause I know how Palin would play it. I know how Cleese would play it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Terry Jones, maybe, I don't know,
but I mean, Gene Wilder, it's not like he's even necessarily being true to the spirit of the character in the book, but he's so good at balancing the sweet and the sour, and he's so approachable and likable with a twinkle, but behind it is this kind of mischievous, I don't know, sense of, you know, hey, I warned you, didn't I? And, you know, it's, I mean, there's a reason why there's the, you know, the condescending Wonka meme out there and stuff like that. There is that kind of side to the character. He's just so good.
It's such a fascinating performance because, you know, he wants you to like him, but he doesn't sort of beg you to like him. He just is like charming and fun and silly. But yeah, there's this weird, menacing, dark side to him, not that he's evil, not in the mean-spirited way that, like, the Johnny Depp character is, but maybe it's just in the way that he's sort of very casual about what happens to the kids, because he knew it was coming, because, you know, these kids are going to disappoint me or whatever. And we talk all the time about, you know, the kinds of movies that we grew up on in our generation. We grew up kind of on 80s movies, when a lot of movies that we watched as kids, whether it was, you know, The Dark Crystal or Time Bandits or some of those kind of fantasy genre movies, there's a weird balance between, yeah, this is approachable for kids, or The Neverending Story. Like, The Neverending Story, yeah, it speaks to this childlike wonder, but there's always stuff that's, like, a little bit scary. Mm-hmm. And Gene Wilder's performance is so good about doing that. And I don't even know how much of that is deliberate or what. You know, everybody points to the scene on the train where he's kind of going, on the boat rather, where he's kind of going crazy and the lights are going nuts and there's all this weird rear projection stuff going on and he seems kind of menacing and insane in that moment. But I mean, his whole performance is sort of pitched in that way, and I wonder if that speaks to why kids are so drawn to that character as we grow up on the movie, because there's something mysterious about him that we're all kind of trying to process, and that's why we keep coming back to it.
Yeah, it's in such a weird place, because I think where someone else could easily have gone and where Depp certainly went.
Yeah, right. Just make him a weirdo, you know.
Yeah, and anything else would take Willy Wonka and make him just something apart from everyone else, right? Almost like just this kind of deity of sorts, just kind of watching over everything that's happening, but being, you know, inapproachable.
Just turn him into, they would have turned him into Pee Wee Herman, which, I mean, I love Pee Wee Herman, that's not what Gene Wilder does at all.
I mean, he reminds me a lot of kind of the Cat in the Hat in some ways, that he's, you know, it's not just the hat. he is a cat in a hat, but, you know, he has this sense of, you know, let's all have fun. But there's also a lot of kind of menace underneath it, not because he wants to hurt anybody, but because there are consequences to things.
Right.
And there are these sort of, not rules necessarily, but, you know, there is a structure in place to how all this kind of imagination and crazy creative stuff works. And you got to kind of be willing to play the game, you know, with everyone else. And if you try to take your ball and go home, you're going to go home stretched to like 10 feet tall or, or covered in garbage or whatever it is. So, you know, rewatching the scene on the boat, and I actually watched a little bit of the movie today with my daughter, cause I wanted to kind of get her take on it. Mm-hmm. And we got to that scene and I told her, this is going to be a little spooky, a little scary. And we were watching it, and I could see her getting a little nervous about it. And I said, you know, are you scared? She was kind of nodding a little bit. And I said, you know, he's just pretending. And she got that. Like, whatever it is about his character, she's like, oh, okay, he's just pretending to be that way.
Yeah.
And then as soon as that scene is over, you know, someone's like, you know, stop the boat. You know, it was just gone on long enough. I said, yeah, you're right, stop the boat. And then, you know, he switches on to something else. It's just kind of – it's just another game he's playing. It's
right.
He's not actually – you know, being menacing in that moment, and any harm that happens to the kids over the course of the movie is, you know, it's their own fault. It's not because he has done anything to hurt them, which is different perhaps than what's suggested in the Tim Burton version.
One of the, and that's, again, I don't mean to keep just comparing the two movies, but I remember one of my issues with the Burton film was that the characterization of Charlie Bucket was so saintly. He was such a little, God bless us, everyone, Tiny Tim, like almost goody-goody, that there was no test. And that's ultimately what the movie comes down to, at least it's supposed to. It's not about Willy Wonka reconciling his feelings about his absentee father, but it's a test in which one of these kids is going to pass it and inherit the factory. And you could almost tell, especially in the Burton version, when all five kids show up, he could have just sent four of them home and said, well, you, the one who always says the right thing and is perfect, you get the factory. And that's one of the reasons why I don't hate the fizzy lifting drink scene. I know it's new and I know it kind of flies in the face of testing Charlie's character. But I think it humanizes him in a way that never happens in the Burton version, where he is a kid and he is tempted to do this thing, but it doesn't define who he is as a person. And ultimately he still does the right thing. You know, the other four kids are just sort of, they're going to be awful no matter what. And I like that this movie says, no, you can slip, you can make mistakes, but it doesn't completely determine your future. Willy Wonka doesn't say, nope, you drank the thing, get out. I mean, he does, but then obviously he goes back on it. That it doesn't.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, fit it. Go ahead. I'm done.
No, that's true. And in that moment, it humanizes Charlie. And it also, you know, shows that when he's faced with the realization that he's made a mistake, he's willing to kind of back away from it and, you know, admit what he did was wrong.
Right.
And I think what happens to everyone else is they keep pushing further, even when they're told, you probably don't want to do that. Why don't you stop?
Right.
Please don't do this. You can't have the goose. You squirrels in the original book, but you know, you can't, you know, you don't chew the gum, you know, get away from the TV camera, whatever it is. And they just don't listen.
Right.
And they never kind of admit their mistake. They just keep going. I mean, even you know, even after my TV's been shrunk, you know, to, you know, 2 inches high or whatever it is, he's still, you know, completely, you know, excited that he did the thing he did. It's absolutely no, you know, remorse over what happened. So I can accept that. And the fizzy lifting drink scene obviously never bothered me when I was a kid because I didn't know anything different.
And burping is funny.
Burping is hilarious. But you know, it's only kind of now as I try to kind of reevaluate it, then thinking, well, is that really in the spirit of the thing? And does it ruin it? And I don't think it does, because I think they found a pretty good way around it to still have Charlie make the final choice that cements him as being, you know, the right person. I mean, when he's actually faced with, you know, not just, okay, you didn't listen when I told you not to do this thing. You made a, you know, you're a kid and you made a dumb kid move. It's, you know, you have the choice now to not only stick it to the guy who just yelled at you and told you to get out of his office, but also make enough money to make sure your family, you know, is going to survive. And he decides to do the right thing, give it back, and not, you know, that's a more powerful moment, I think, for that character. And, you know, the book is great, but, you know, the characters are all pretty flat. I mean, they all have like a defining characteristic that's basically their last name. Well, that's not true. TV, okay. My TV is only character. I was going to say, what does Charlie Bucket have to, you know?
Yeah,
he's a bucket, clearly a bucket. But no, I mean they all have one character, you know, one thing that defines them, and it all kind of represents something that I assume Roald Dahl didn't like about kids.
The way they're always chewing gum.
The way they're always chewing gum, for instance. Another interesting departure from the book is in the book, when they do the Oompa Loompa songs, there were these poems that would go on for like three pages that were like stories about this kid who chewed gum and bit her tongue off. And Tim Burton actually, you know, bless his little heart, he actually like tried to do the full text of those things with those, you know, highly choreographed Oompa Loompa songs in his thing. Whereas I think the 71 version makes a good choice of just having this, the Oompa Loompa, doopity, do songs. They change the lyrics slightly. It's direct. It's to the point. It's quick. It kind of, they sort of act as the, you know, if I only had a heart, if I only had a brain, if I only had a, you know, some courage songs from Wizard of Oz, like it's just sort of this simple structure, but it just, it addresses what's happening right then. So I don't think it would do anyone any good to try to just film the Roald Dahl book, because the book is its own thing. And obviously Burton had the chance to do that, and he decided he, you know, didn't want to just do that either. So, there's room to play. And, you know, I think that, that excuses a lot of the departures in the 71 version.
Well, and Tim Burton's move for everything is just to always claim that he's going back to the source so that he can shit on the previous version. And it makes me crazy, because the only reason that Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the movie, exists is because there's such goodwill for the film. I mean, I know it's a classic children's book too, but he's essentially remaking the movie. I know he claims he's going back to the book, but had the original film not been such a classic, there would have been no audience for his 2005 version, which made what, 100 times what I think Willy Wonka made, about $4 million.
Yeah, probably.
And the Burton one made about $400 million. Proof that box office is no reflection of quality, because that's only possible because everybody loves the original film. And so for him to, for some reason, like, be nasty about that movie and say, oh yeah, they got it all wrong, and I'm going to do it for real, and then also not do it for real, just make it the Johnny Depp is quirky show. Oh, he infuriates me.
He does. Going back to something more positive, okay, something good that we like.
Yes.
you mentioned earlier some of the kind of weird comedy bits in the movie.
Yeah.
And there's a whole kind of section when they're looking for the golden tickets that I love. I mean, it's kind of out of step with a lot of other stuff that happens in the movie. And I kind of wonder who wrote it, whether Roald Dahl wrote it. Because some of those bits, there's the one with the scientist and the computer.
Yeah.
Is similar to something that's referenced in the book. There's a part in the book, it's just, I think, part of a news story about a scientist who invented a machine – computer that could detect whenever there was gold around, and there was a mishap where, you know, ripped the necklace off of some, you know, duchess who happened to be there, and they got to adapt it for the thing. And that's a great scene. You know, I love the line, you know, I'm now telling the computer exactly what to do. It's great. And, like, you know, seeing the van pull up to the White House is great.
Right. Your Majesty,
the auction. I mean, all of those are really good, you know, bits. I really like that. I'm glad that kind of stuff is in there. Even just kind of like seemingly throwaway parts, like Charlie interacting with his, you know, science teacher in his school, like all these things that kind of have nothing to do with the, you know, the story of what happens when you get into the chocolate factory. Are all memorable in their own way. They all kind of have something interesting going on.
Well, they're fun, and thank goodness, because, like I said, they take up half the movie's running time. Yeah. I love the teacher when he's doing the percentage demonstration. John says, I only opened two, and he says, I can't figure out just two. But those – you're exactly right. Those scenes, while very funny, feel totally different than the rest of the movie, feel like they were written by somebody else. They feel like they come from sort of a very British version of the movie, almost like those come from the Monty Python version of Willy Wonka. It's a crazy movie because it's clearly shot in Germany. There's all these German flags everywhere, but parts of it feel very British. A lot of, you know, the people that Charlie interacts with have British accents, but not everyone, and he doesn't, but his grandpa kind of does. Yeah. And in a way, that's part of its charm, that it sort of takes place everywhere and nowhere.
And that I think is actually true across all versions. I mean, even the Roald Dahl book doesn't say where it takes place.
Right.
I mean, obviously, he's a British author. You sort of assume that it takes place in England. But when Charlie finds the money on the street, they very specifically says it's a dollar. So does it take place in America? Does it take place somewhere else? And I know that they shot the 71 version in Munich, not, you know, partly because it was cheaper, but also to kind of give it a, you know, we're not going to pin down where this takes place type of feel. And I think Burton kind of goes for the same thing as well.
Well, his takes place in Tim Burton world. So even before get to the factory, everything is weird and stylized. Yes. I kind of like, though, I recognize that the stylization, especially of the Burton movie, does kind of match the some of the stylization of, you know, Roald Dahl's writing. But I kind of like the weird, down-to-earth way that the 71 film presents it. The grandparents all sleeping in the same bed and never not being in bed is such a, it's such a kind of Roald Dahl visual. Yeah. It's such a, such an idea that seems like, you know, right out of one of his books. And I kind of like that the 71 film, it presents it in a very sort of matter of fact way. And I know you had said it doesn't really like underscore the poverty, and that's true. Although, I mean, I definitely get a sense of it, especially when he goes to visit his mom at work. But I like how matter of factly it's shot, as though just, yeah, they're always in this bed together and we don't see them out of the bed, and they don't call a ton of attention to it. And the other things in the house aren't necessarily overly stylized in that way. I don't know. I kind of like the way that it takes a very kind of realistic, for lack of a better word, approach to that Roald Dahl visual.
Yeah. I think that is a good way to describe it. I think I was a little, maybe I reacted to it a little bit differently because I did just read the book. And so I kind of had that kind of just crazy Roald Dahl visual stuff in my mind.
Right.
So to sort of come to the point where it's like, you know, Charlie has a paper route. So he's got some money. There's some money coming. I guess if he actually had no money coming in, like in the book, then yeah, they'd all just die. Like, you can't really do that. So yeah, he had to give Charlie a paper route where he can take him just enough money to buy a loaf of bread for his family.
Right.
That's fine. You know, yeah, yeah. It's a world where, yeah, Grandpa Joe can afford, you know, one pipe tobacco, whatever's a day, a week, whatever it is. Like, okay, it's not a lot of money. He doesn't have a lot
right,
of money.
Right.
He can afford to have his mom and his grandmother's knit him a scarf for his birthday, like a Rockefeller. But but he's, you know, but yes, he's definitely not well to do.
And again, the matter of fact way with which that first half is shot to me really helps the second half when they're inside the factory kind of pop. Like, oh right, this is its own crazy fantasy reality. We're now in Wonka world, you know. Whereas, again, not to keep bringing up the Burton version, but because the whole movie is so stylized, it's the set design changes, but the actual aesthetic of the film doesn't really change. What do you think of the songs? No, how do you?
I've always liked the songs. I still, you know, they are internalized to me. I don't know if I can really separate myself from the songs. I think they're all really good. I mean, you know, Cheer Up Charlie's not the greatest one, but that's
the one
fine.
I forgot until I was watching it today. I mean, and I was, that's, why is the mom doing this entire song while he just mopes on the street like sad peanuts on Arrested Development?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's the most kind of like musical moment of the movie, in the sense that it's the kind of thing where you have if you have a super long Broadway musical, there's always like a few songs that feel like, you know, they could probably be cut and it'd be fine. And that's, you know, that's a moment that I guess makes some sense. It's not a terrible song. I certainly, you know, I remember it when I hear it. I'm like, oh, it's fine. But, you know, one, you know, songs like, you know, Pure Imagination, the Oompa Loompa songs.
Right.
You know, even like I've Got a Golden Ticket, like I know them, like they're catchy, you know, I've been humming them all week. Like I like them. I think they're way more memorable than whatever songs, you know, were in the Burton version that we obviously hate.
Yeah. I didn't like, and I know that he was kind of going for different, my memory is that like each one is in a different genre or style, right?
That is true.
I did not like that. The Candyman, is that original to Willy Wonka?
Apparently it is. I thought that it was.
Thought that was like a standard.
Me too. But I think it was in the documentary or the making of on the DVD that you know, they wrote it for the movie, and that's where Sammy Davis Jr. heard it and he covered it from there.
Okay.
I think they even said something about he wanted to play the Candyman part in the movie at one point. They were talking about that. So yeah, apparently it came from Willy Wonka. So that's, you know, that's a song everyone knows.
And that's a classic song. And, cool. and I will say the way that it is staged is like really dull in this movie. I'm hearing this, you know, now classic song, and it's just a dude behind the counter, like in kind of a one shot. I was amazed that they didn't try and maybe give that one a little more visual panache. And maybe that would again fly in the face of what I was saying, where the first half is treated more realistically. I guess had they gone for like a full-on musical kind of production number, it might have broken with the reality that they were trying to set up. But
yeah, I think they actually shot that like way ahead of anything else. Like, okay. I heard that somewhere that, you know, a lot of the musical stuff was kind of done beforehand. And then that I think in particular was kind of just shot separate. I think maybe even before they'd finished the script and stuff like that. So they were kind of fitted in.
They should have gone back and reshot it at the end, yeah. And like said, hey, let's really open this thing with a bang and not just this dude mumbling a song behind the counter.
I assume all those kids have tabs or something, because he's just throwing candy.
How does he stay
kids.
In business? He's like, he's like Amy Poehler and They Came Together.
Everyone go watch that movie. It's true. And then he's like, you know, he's hemming Charlie when he's, you know.
Yeah, right?
The starving kid is wolfing down his crumbs in the Upshifts bar.
I'll take the scarf, like, son.
Exactly. Oh yeah, that was interesting. I think that, you know, speaking of kind of the way the movie is shot, it's not. I mean, the visuals are striking, but I don't think there's a whole lot of interesting stuff happening.
No, it's not real. It's dynamic.
Very straightforward.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a few kind of notable shots that go beyond just, you know, the way the set's dressed. I mean, there's a great shot when Augustus Gloop finds the ticket, where you start with the reporter who's got the antlers coming out of his head. That stuck out to me. You know what I mean? Like the antlers are on the wall. They're
right. Right.
It's fine. You know, but it's very straightforward. But it's kind of amazing that the people who I saw in the featurette made this movie that turned out to be anything other than just commercial garbage. I don't know much about Mel Stewart, the director. He doesn't seem to have made very many other movies.
No, not well. I mean, he worked a ton, but not a lot of feature films, and certainly not many things that I've seen. Again,
I'm probably reacting more to the producer guy, who seemed to be very dismissive of Dahl in the talk of the feature. So I think he got my heckles.
Well, there's candy to be sold. I feel like had I just seen this movie for the first time today, and if I wasn't growing up with it and very familiar with the beats, I might be not irritated is the wrong word, but once it gets into the factory, it does set up a pretty repetitive structure. And I mean, that's just built into the story, where it's like, we go into this room and this kid falls away. And then we go into this room and this kid falls away. And I found myself, I was watching the movie or trying to watch it with my son, who's 5. And by the time we got to Mike TV, I felt like the movie had peaked, mm-hmm. and that Mike TV was almost one little episode too many. And obviously they're not going to get rid of one. I don't know if they needed to get to the factory sooner. Like, my movie clock said, this is the wrong beat for this point in the movie. We should already be in Wonka's office, which is a weird thing to feel, but it really is, you know, just a very repetitive structure once they get to the factory, and almost setting up the factory too. It's kind of repetitive because it's this one found a ticket and then we wait and now another ticket was found. And then they just reverse that structure on the way out. And now this kid's gone. And now this kid's gone.
Yeah. I mean, even my memory of the movie kind of checks out at a certain point, because I always forget about this scene. And it's kind of a scene, almost a scene they felt like they had to put something in there just to make the transition when they get on the car and they're covered with the suds.
Yeah.
Like that is, I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of got some funny stuff. I don't know. It's not great, but it's such a kind of nothing scene, but they needed something to follow
to
up.
To break up. Right.
Yeah. I mean, everything that happened before they get to the elevator.
And and at least it gives that, you know, little visual gag where they cross through the frame. And because like you said, there's not a ton of that going on in the movie. It's shot pretty matter of factly. It's the sets and the production design that do most of the heavy lifting, even inside the factory.
So what did you think of Charlie as a kid actor?
You know, he's fine. I don't know. I have a hard time divorcing myself because I am so familiar with him. He's fine. Like, I appreciate the fact that he plays a couple of beats that don't make him not. It's not that he's ever unlikable, but he does have a little bit of self-pity to him. And he is a little bit of a mope at times. He's not this little trooper that Freddie Highmore is. And again, there's a weird disconnect because it feels like all of his lines are looped, even though I don't think they are. Mm-hmm. His haircut is very dated, and so that ends up dating the movie a little bit. And I know he never went on to act again, right? This is the only thing he ever did.
This is his only credit, as far as I know.
That's fascinating. So I almost can't. I can't even tell if it's a good performance at this point because it just is. It's this thing that I grew up with and I'm so familiar with that I have no gauge of whether he's good or bad.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I guess, true to the character, he's kind of the least interesting of all the kids.
Right.
But I think you're right. He is fine. Trademark.
Again, I give the movie credit for letting him feel like a real kid and even kind of look like a real kid. You know, he doesn't necessarily look like this perfect kid out of central casting. His face has a little bit more character to it, even though his smile is a little bit blank and, you know,
we have Gene Wilder as Willy Wonka.
Yes.
Who is part bizarre caricature and part, you know, believable guy. And then he bridges the, you know, realistic Charlie with the caricature kids. He is the bridge.
I like it.
You see what I'm saying?
I do.
He embodies all the characterizations of the bad kids and the good kid. He's kind of like what Paul Rudd is to all of his basketball playing friends. Again, see that movie. I love, you know, speaking to kind of like just a lot of the little throwaway stuff. I think the parents are pretty great. I think even the parents who don't end up at the factory get some great moments. Mike TV's dad, the whole thing about, you know, him wanting a Colt revolver, you know, not so you're 12, son.
Right.
And the parents are, I think, have a lot more personality in this movie than in the Burton one, where they're either kind of nothing or they're given some kind of weird focus like by Beauregard in that one is like an overachieving karate kid with the Missy Pyle mom who just wants her to be, you know, number one. And I like in this one, you know, her dad's just the used car salesman politician from Montana, which is kind of perfect.
Well, and it was interesting watching it today for the first time as an adult, especially with children of my own, because growing up, I mean, it's very much. And one of the things I like about it is it's very much sort of this morality tale for kids. It speaks directly to kids. Kids, be good or else. You know, kids, be nice or else. And you may want to act a certain way sometimes, but don't. Because this is what happens to asshole kids, you know. And again, the Burton version kind of gets away from that because it's so focused just on Willy Wonka. So I very much watched it through those eyes as a kid. Like, oh, this is a warning to me. I better be nice. And watching it now, it's much more – I mean, it's still that. It still says that about and to kids. But it's also more of an indictment of the parents than I think I realized when I was a kid. That now that I have kids, it's speaking to me as, hey, don't let your kids be assholes. Because all of the parents are garbage parents too. You know, they spoil their kids. They indulge their kids. And they are sort of – they've let their kids grow up to be monsters.
Yeah, and I think that's an improvement over the book in which the parents are really blank slates too. It's the kids that are terrible. The parents are just sort of along for the ride.
Right.
I think the – you know, Veruca's dad is, I think, you know, a real standout in the movie.
Yeah.
As someone I think who you know, wants to please his daughter, but I think at some point he sort of sees like he's just gotten to the point in his life where it's his only – course of action. He has to make her happy or else he's going to be miserable.
Right.
I don't think he necessarily thinks that he's doing the right thing all the time, but it's just kind of all he knows how to do.
Right.
I think the adults are great. Like, you know, Grandpa Joe doesn't seem maybe as old as he would be in the Roald Dahl version, but to your point, it's a very kind of grounded, you know, you can't really expect a 90-year-old, rail thin guy who's been in bed for 20 years to hop up and shout yippee and then go to the chocolate factory. So.
Well, and that's the thing about Roald Dahl books is that they are so exaggerated in certain ways that to try and actually bring that to life on screen would be almost impossible. It's like trying to make a movie out of a Shel Silverstein poem. You know, it's like, nah, there's certain things that just won't work, especially in 1971 before the advent of CGI and stuff. Because now we would just get a CGI Grandpa Joe. He'd be like Grandpa Jar Jar.
he'd be like that dancing guy from the Six Flags commercials.
Oh, yikes. That thing gives me nightmares.
You know, I just had a chill went up my spine because I just imagined Tim Burton's Sarah Something of Sylvia Stout coming out summer 2017.
Starring Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter.
Absolutely. Somehow. Somehow. Johnny Depp is the dish. I don't know what Johnny Depp's going to do, but he's going to make it amazing.
Oh, I have been so tempted because leading up to, what are we at? Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which I'm really excited about. I've been going back and rewatching all the old Apes movies, and I'm so tempted to revisit the Tim Burton one, but I know it's a mistake. I know I shouldn't do it because this has happened to me before where every couple of years I'm like, no, maybe it's better than I remember. I remember the makeup being really incredible, and then I can barely get through that movie.
I never saw that one.
Really?
I remember the trailers and thinking, oh, I should check that. This is, again, kind of at the time where I thought, Tim Burton. It must have been that Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was enough of a known quantity to me that I thought, okay, I will make an effort to see that because I'd fallen out of interest in Tim Burton. It was right around the same time. This is kind of Planet of the Apes. Tim Burton was around the time that I kind of started to not be as excited for every M. Night Shyamalan trailer that came out too. They kind of went hand in hand for whatever reason. It was like, oh, I want to see what they do to. I'm probably not going to see that. So I never saw that one.
Yeah, Planet of the Apes was kind of the first chink in the armor, which isn't to say that every movie he had made prior was a masterpiece, but
For what I understand, I mean, that's another movie where he just takes a bizarre turn at the end. That,
oh, yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense. I can't get over what he does with Willy Wonka. And that, I mean, it's just, it ruins
no, it
the
make,
whole
no,
thing.
It makes it better. See, you're looking at it all wrong. It's better.
It's
because
terrible.
It's newer.
Here's what happened. Here's one. I mean, there are many moments that made me turn against the movie. But rewatching Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the moment when Charlie wins, he's shaking Charlie's hand and says, "You won. You get the factory." And Charlie says, "Great. Can I bring my family?" And Wonka says, "Of course you can't." And that is the moment when it's just like, where he's like, why would you want to bring your family? You'd be free of your family. All that kind of nonsense.
Right.
Like, that is not the character. That is some crazy.
That's
crazy.
Tim Burton, right. Where it's just that like, no, I don't. Why would you want human contact? And that doesn't even make sense. Again, that characterization of Willy Wonka, it doesn't even make sense that he would give up his factory because what would he be without that factory? He's a crazy shut-in Howard Hughes. Like, he can't exist in the world. Like the Gene Wilder one, could go, maybe he's going to go start, do something else, create a new life for himself, or he could just go exist. Like he could be a person in the world. The right. Johnny Depp Willy Wonka cannot exist outside the walls of that factory. So how are we supposed to believe he's giving it up?
The Johnny Depp Willy Wonka is like the worst of the kids. He is a kid. He's a kid in that movie. Yeah. He's the sixth kid and he's the worst one.
Yeah, again, Tim Burton, not great at understanding material. I don't think. I think he tends to screw things up. And the weird thing about his Planet of the Apes, which I know we're not talking about, it feels almost the least Tim Burton. It's a bad adaptation only because it's a movie without any personality. Like, usually he takes something that exists and Tim Burtons it up to the point where you can't stand it anymore. With Planet of the Apes, he gives it no personality. I would almost, welcome a more Tim Burton-y version just so the movie had personality, but then it might resemble something like his Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So,
yeah. I mean, I would like to see the 71 Willy Wonka with like the chocolate room of the Tim Burton version.
Right.
I think that's a more, like some of the visuals are super impressive in the Tim Burton version, obviously because that's what he's good at.
Well, and the technology had caught up with the ability to realize some of the stuff that Roald Dahl wrote. And that's true. Yeah, you can create a much more visually impressive chocolate factory. That is absolutely true. And that is where that movie, I guess, is superior to the original.
But I mean, I guess the fact that it was 1971, they were able to get some pretty cool stuff for, you know, what was essentially a candy commercial financed by the Quaker Oats people. And the end of that story of the of this, this candy bar that it was supposed to tie in with was that the candy bar comes out same time as the movie. There's a problem with the candy bar. There's some problem with the formulation. They have to recall the candy bar because they just melt on store shelves.
That's wild. I didn't hear that part.
Yeah. So it was a failed tie-in. Really, and the movie didn't do that great. Like you said, it didn't make a whole lot of money at first. It was really just later it caught on
right.
home video.
Right.
And I, which is so in a sense, even though I didn't see it until the 80s, I was probably part of that wave.
Oh,
of,
for sure. Yeah. Because I don't think it was in the 70s that it caught on.
Yeah. So this is I'm not sure if when you put this podcast up, if it's going to be for the 1971 Willy Wonka or the Tim Burton version, because I think we've talked, even though you haven't seen the Burton version since it was out in theaters, I think we talked about it in equal lengths.
Well, yeah, right, because now the good news is I never have to go back and do a show just on the Tim Burton ones because I don't want to watch it again.
Are there any other movies you never want to do a podcast on? We could talk about briefly.
Yeah,
the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes. Any Tim Burton movie, really, we could knock them out right.
I could do a podcast on pretty much every Tim Burton movie because it would be a lot of. This is what frustrates me, even though I like a lot of his earlier stuff.
Yeah.
We should try and come up with a list at some point. Not now, obviously, but Willy Wonka and the Lego Movie belong on the list. But these movies that are sort of born out of. Awful motives or just business motives that that wind up being better than not better than they should be that end up, you know, outlasting their sort of cynical origins. I don't know.
I mean, honestly, any movie that's born kind of entirely out of cynical commercial, you know, endeavor, if it's good, it probably belongs on the list.
Yeah, because, but I mean, I mean more than just like, hey, let's do this sequel to cash in on the original. You know, I mean more of like, there aren't very many other good movies based on toys. I mean, Clue the movie, does that count? I don't know.
I mean, I think that's pretty good, but I haven't seen it in a long time either.
And I feel like that was made more so because somebody thought it would be a good movie, not to increase sales of the board game. But maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe it existed just to sell the board game. I don't know.
Yeah.
I thought that was more of a new phenomenon, but it turns out they were doing it all the way back in 71.
That's fair. I mean, obviously E.T. was made for reasons beyond selling Reese's Pieces, but
right.
You know, they're
because they were supposed to sell M&Ms and M&Ms turned them down, the fools.
Right. Fools.
Yeah, take that, M&Ms. You burn. Anyway.
M&Ms, the Tim Burton of the candy world.
Thank you guys very much for listening. Next week's show will be on Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, so make sure you run out and see that and rewatch the Burton version while you're at it, because I'm sure I'll get in some digs on that episode. It'll be my new thing. But thank you, Eric, for talking about this movie.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was a joy.
It was a joy, and hopefully this podcast makes it to the internet and isn't lost forever. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.